People with a could tell you they're right. People with a spread the good light. I hope they keep on shining when no one else is around.
Let me introduce you to the Reverend Tim Costello, one of Australia's most respected community leaders and sought-after voice on social justice issues, leadership and ethics around the world. For 13 years until October 2016, Tim was the Chief Executive Officer of World Vision Australia, and up until earlier this year, he was World Vision's Chief Advocate. In his evocative memoir that's just been released, Tim explores the people and experiences that have shaped him into a fighter for the world's most challenging issues. Please welcome to Bega the one and only Tim Costello.
Well, good morning. This is my first time in Bega, and what a absolutely delightful place. I want to acknowledge the Yuin people, the nation, and their elders, past, present, and future. And in coming here to an Open Minds conference, I want to begin with a question that opens our mind. But to set that question, let me describe a fight between three children over a toy. The toy actually was a musical instrument, a flute. And the first child said, "I should have the flute because I'm so poor, I have no other toys. This would be my only toy." The other two agreed. This was a very, very poor child. The second child said, "I should have the flute because I'm the only one of the three of us that can play the flute." The other two agreed. They couldn't even play a flute. The third child said, "I should have the flute because I'm the one who actually made this flute. And when I finished making it, you two turned up and claimed what is mine." Now, there's no right or wrong answer here. There's no honour shame here. But I'm going to ask you to put up your hands if you think the higher moral claim to the flute is the poorest child. Who would give the flute to the poorest child here? Quite a few hands, maybe 15%. Who here would give the flute to the child who can play the flute? About the same. Finally, who would give the flute to the child who made the flute? Probably just a majority. Thank you. That's an even more open mind lateral solution. I ask that question because when we ask the question, how can we live together, which is really the theme of my talk, the answer is always by living justly, practicing justice. But there are different conceptions of justice. There are profoundly contesting ideas of justice. And when we think we are right and others just don't get us, they actually have a different view of justice. My wife has accompanied me here today. I remember she sending me off when one of our youngest was about 10 to a birthday party. I went as the responsible parent, rarely responsible, but I went. And it was cutting the cake time, blow out the candles, sing happy birthday time, and the mother of the birthday boy whipped off the candles, started cutting up the cake. And there was an American mum there who had an American child. And she just said, "Oh, what are you doing?" to the Australian mum. And she said, "Oh, look, I'm just cutting up the cake. This is our practice. We let the kids take it home or they can have their piece now." I remember the American mum said, "Well, that's not fair." And the Australian mum said, "What?" And I looked at her and she looked at me. She said, that's not fair. And the Australian mum said, look, every child is getting a piece and it's exactly the same size piece. It couldn't be fairer. What do you mean it's not fair? The American mum said, because you haven't asked the children if they want a piece and what size piece they want. Now, we laugh at that, but there is a strand of justice in there. Agency, choice, freedom. Here was another way of contesting ideas around justice. Well, I want to really pose the question of how do we do justice in an age of anxiety? We are in a profound age of anxiety at the moment. People like Israel Folau think we're in an age where we should be feeling guilty. Back in medieval times, people felt guilty, less than anxious. Their only question was, how can I escape the wrath of an angry God for my sins? And if you know your church history, the Reformation answer was a good answer to medieval questions of guilt. You know, it's faith alone, it's grace alone, it's nothing you can do, you can't earn your salvation. It was a good answer. Israel Folau, with his tweets, thinks that's the question we're still asking today in the culture. How can we escape our guilt? Only for us to have what I regard as a pretty insane debate in this country around the Israel Folau issue. People aren't feeling guilty, they're feeling anxious. The anxiety is everywhere. We're feeling anxious because of a whole range of things. It's curious we're feeling anxious because if you read Hans Rosling's book on Factfulness, he will show we have never made more progress in human history. Just one stat. Back in 1947, China and India both had 42% of their population, same figure, living in absolute poverty. That's less than $2 a day. Try and live on that. Now, India has reduced that figure from 42% in absolute poverty to 12%. That's still a couple of 100 million Indians, by the way. But it's remarkable. China has reduced it to 0.5% living in absolute poverty. When we look at lifting people out of poverty, when we look at crime decreasing around the world, wars, notwithstanding the Syria war, which has been a blip, decreasing since the Second World War, we actually are living longer, we are healthier, we are beating poverty. Climate change is another story, and I'll get to that. That's the one exception of where we're really deeply in trouble. But everywhere else, we should be feeling hopeful. Yet we're anxious. We are profoundly anxious. Politicians are playing on that anxiety with messages of fear. I said in the Sydney Morning Herald, I think it was last week, there's only really two emotions that humans feel, fear or hope. And politicians are playing us on a break on fear. Even though we should be feeling hopeful, with the exception maybe of climate change, we actually are making enormous progress on just about every other indicator. One stat that's very personal for me. When I started at World Vision 16 years ago, I'd say today 30,000 kids under the age of 5 will die of stupid poverty. It's dirty water. It's not getting enough calories to get through the day. It's a preventable disease that we can treat. That's why it's stupid, because we can do clean water. The world has enough food. Plenty of food to feed itself. Why are they dying? 30,000 kids under the age of 5. Today, it will be under 15,000 kids under the age of 5 dying. And when people say, oh, African Asian mums, they don't feel grief like Australian mums, let me say, you don't get that leave pass. They feel exactly the same grief. And as you lift people out of poverty, guess what happens? They move to having just 2, at the most 3 kids. It's a very rational decision to have lots of babies when you're poor, because there's no social security age pension. That's why having a lot of kids who will feed you is absolutely rational. It's what your great-grandparents did in Australia, by the way, when we were poor. As you move people out of poverty, and we're seeing this with the declining population growth rates, you stop births and population. Parents go, I want my kids educated. I can only afford two. We should be feeling very hopeful in saving lives, lifting people out of poverty, stopping them, then having the motivation of having lots of kids. But we're anxious, profoundly anxious. The anxiety and the fear is curious to me. I've just retired from World Vision. I'm 64. My father lived to 97. I'm thinking, wow, if I live that long, that's another 33 years. What am I going to do? And then my mind turns to, am I going to have enough money to live on? Have you noticed just about every second ad on TV is about superannuation? Have I got enough? How long am I going to live? This, you know, industry super. We are anxious. When I speak to school principals and teachers, they'll tell me parents are literally up in their offices abusing them that they haven't recognised how special their child is. And their grades simply don't reflect how special and gifted their child is. This morning's news is one of the desperate housewives going to prison in America for bribing to get their daughter into a college. The anxiety is quite profound when at times when we should be most hopeful. This is very, very curious. The anxiety plays out in mean politics. The Tamil family that Australia has taken to its heart, we're told, sorry, you cannot be compassionate to this family because it leads to bad precedents. Compassion has been abolished. We're not allowed to feel compassionate for them. Having been up on Manus, I know why journalists aren't allowed on Manus Island, because as I saw, when you look in the faces of people like Baruz, who won the Premier's Prize for No Friend But the Mountain, you actually see humans who were refugees fleeing, as you and I would. But if you keep them anonymous, if you don't let any journalists there, if you don't tell their story, that's why we haven't been able to allow journalists on the Manus and Nauru. Well, this is anxiety playing out. The CEO of Cambridge Analytica that got a 60 million Facebook users and targeted in a micro way messages under the radar in the presidential election in America, literally said, this is what he said, we don't worry about facts, we just make them up. We will target messages to people's fears and hopes under the radar, and they won't even know why they're voting, because with their Facebook likes, we know more about them than they know about themselves, than their partner knows about them. Surveillance capitalism is this extraordinary moment because of all of our digital fingerprints every time we go online, where now these big data companies can sell for profit to businesses business models which predict our behaviour with such unerring accuracy. It takes the risk out of marketing. It takes the freedom away, really. They know. They know more about us, and they can predict our behaviour than we know. Well, in this time of anxiety, we start to ask the question, how can we live together? How can there be justice? Let me come back to that by saying I think the source of our anxiety is that we have been seeing communities fragment. This is why I think a community coming together is so powerful. We are social beings where we know that we need to belong to each other. The retribalizing happening in our world in scary ways, because the world's rearming to the teeth, and when the world rearms, you know what follows. And it's profoundly fearful. That retribalizing is a backlash to globalization, to saying, Who's my tribe? Who's there when I'm alone? Who gets my humour? But the hyper-individualism of both left and right politics has left us as lonely individuals in fragmenting communities. Social media has only formed us into communities through algorithms of like-minded people who whip themselves up into a frenzy that they're a victim and fear the other. You know, when you take those like-minded people out of their algorithm social media communities and sit them with people who are different, it's amazing how quickly they'll move to compromise and understanding. It's amazing how quickly religious people who are against gay marriage and very strongly saying this is my religious freedom, when they have a nephew or a niece who's gay and hear their story, it changes everything. But the false community of algorithms has led us really into a culture online that says you disagree with me equals you hate me and I'm a victim and I'm going to get you. The hyper-individualism came from left and right. In the 60s, the left said, and it had some freedom motives, let's free ourselves from the restraints and the traditions and the taboos. We had the pharmaceutical revolution with drugs saying, I'm going to experience my own chemical experiences. We had the sexual revolution and I won't be bound by traditional taboos and restraints. Maybe good in lifting some of those restraints, but what it did was leave people as lonely individuals. The right did exactly the same. We're going to give you profound freedom with your choice in the market, distributing your preferences into the market, spitting out brands back at you that will give you a pseudo community. Look at the car I drive, the brand labels I have. Look at the schools my kids go to. I am somebody. I've made it. I look in the mirror and I have a great story to tell about myself because I've bought these brands. The right with economic rationalism did the same and left us with lonely individualism. Both left and right did that. I think we are made for community. I have formed this view after rigorous research on one of the great academic films, Crocodile Dundee. There's Mick in America, blown away in a bar that every American he talks to has a therapist. And he's puzzled, he scratches his head, he says, what's the matter with you people? Don't you have mates? And the American says, but if you don't have therapists in Australia, how do you solve your problems? And Mick thinks, he says, well, if I've got a problem at Walkabout Creek, I go to the pub, order a beer, Wally behind the bar, over a beer, here's my problem. Wally ends up telling the whole bar. And then no more problem. Now, that's a terrible counselling technique. Don't do it. But here's the germ of truth. Almost all our problems are relational. Just think about it. Because we're social beings. And when there's interference in our relationships, the pain is great. What a good counsellor does is listen and say, do you need to forgive? Do you need to confront? Do you need to draw a line in the sand because you've tried everything and move on? A good counsellor just listens. But our problems are all relational. We are made for community. The anxiety of individualism is such that in Australia, 40% of Australians now eat dinner most nights alone. Just a TV or a laptop they're watching. This profound fragmentation. Well, when you multiply this anxiety out, it starts to explain it's not actually the things going on in the world that we should be anxious about, though there are some, and I'm going to get to it, but it's within ourselves, within the loss of community and belonging. Well, let me go back to my first story about the flute and try and wrap this up. In America, the child that made the flute, liberalism it's called, always wins. Property rights, America was established at the time of the philosopher John Locke, who wrote on liberty. It's why in America, liberty is the catch cry for everything. It's why they have had largely unregulated capitalism. And we saw this with the bank crises. It's why you can't get gun control, because anything a state does interfering with the individual liberty of my right to carry a gun. Liberty is the touchstone. It was right from its founding, Pilgrim Fathers. We are free. John Locke's liberty, of particularly of the individual, which made sense with some of the restraints back in 18th century, 17th century Britain. In America, though, that liberty has led to profound disparity. I was shocked in the Democratic debates yesterday. I was watching for the candidates. One said, I hadn't heard this figure, Andrew Yang, he said, now three Americans have wealth equal to 50% of the population in America. Liberty that allows such inequality. We know globally it's 27 individuals have wealth equal to half the world's population. This is the liberty idea that allows excellence. You can see it in a film called The Pursuit, where he actually says Stockholm and Scandinavian countries are boring. The idea of America allows excellence and innovation, and there's truth in that. Truth in the entrepreneurial innovation that is released, but at the cost of equality. That's the girl who made the flute. It's mine, and as Americans, Donald Trump's responsive to, say, I made my wealth. Taxation is theft. Therefore, Trump lowers the taxation always. In Scandinavian countries, they would give the flute to the poorest child. They say, we're not totally socialist. You know, communism at its simplest was a protest against inequality, but it led to the equality of everybody being poor. It didn't work. Scandinavian countries aren't socialist in that sense, but they say, actually, we believe there shouldn't be inequality. We are going to invest the taxes, and they vote for this, higher taxes in health, in education, in infrastructure, in regions. So the Bega Valley, which has some wealth here and has a whole lot of people, a new start, we're going to invest it there. That is the egalitarian model, the Scandinavian model that the Anglos often look down on. Well, the Australian model really is the utilitarian model. We would give the flute to the child who can play it, because utilitarianism says greatest happiness for that child and greatest happiness for those who can hear that child play, so the majority benefits. That's why most of us, middle class and up, got tax cuts in the last election, but we can't raise Newstart. The majority feels better off. Now, we're feeling a little bit guilty about it, but there's going to be no movement on $40 a day on Newstart, because the majority has been benefited. It's, in my view, tragic. The Economist called Australia the wonder down under. 28 years of growth, no recession, the only country in the world, and we've left Australians who are out of work on trying to survive on $40 a day. But don't worry, the majority of us got our tax cuts. We're better off. The economy's better off. That's why on climate change, we're finding it so difficult to work it out from a utilitarian perspective. Tony Abbott got this one right. He said, when climate change is a moral issue, the coalition does badly. When climate change is an economic issue, the coalition wins. We weigh up in utilitarian cost-benefit analyses, dealing with climate change and the cost to that, versus our energy prices going up. And we can't quite in a utilitarian way work this one out. When it's just a moral issue, we go, of course, or Tony Abbott admits, but we're so profoundly utilitarian in the big issue facing us, our security versus our prosperity. We're struggling to work this out from a utilitarian way. What's going to benefit the majority? Our security, we're told, and has always been, relies with America. Right through our history, Australia's needed one, just one, great dependable friend. First it was Britain, then after the Coral Sea battle it was America. We have always felt for our security and values, we have to have one great dependable friend. New Zealand and EU and other nations seem to be able to have a more nuanced foreign policy, not us. That fear. But our economic prosperity is with China. And we've always been told, oh, we don't worry, we don't have to choose between our economic prosperity and our security and values. Well, that formula has now just become a wish. When ScoMo has his special lunch in the White House with Donald Trump, Trump is going to put the acid on him. You have to choose. We want you doing, with America, freedom of navigation through the South China Sea. We want you to stand up, or as Pompeo, who was here 3 weeks ago, the Secretary of State said, what, Australia, would you sell your soul for a pile of soya beans? In other words, just for a bit of prosperity? But this is a genuinely troubling debate from a utilitarian perspective. What's going to benefit the majority? How are we going to actually decide this, rather than what's called virtue ethics, morality and human rights? Well, in this re-tribalising world, human rights are being rolled back. We are finding our tribe in narrow ways because of the loss of community, because of the individualism and the anxiety. More of us are flying the flag, the Australian flag. I think it's really important, and I should finish with this by saying there is a profound difference between patriotism and nationalism. I love Australia. I'm a passionate Australian. I was sitting up to all hours last night, as I have for the last 2 weeks, watching the Ashes. I am thrilled Australia won and that we won the Ashes without using sandpaper. That's patriotism. Love of place, love of culture, love of the Bega Valley, the Sapphire Coast. It's patriotism. Nationalism is different. Nationalism is when you say, and my country is the best, the greatest, and compare it over and against others. I was in Hamburg at the G20. I lead civil society, the C20. That's an outreach group of the G20. Angela Merkel was the chancellor hosting at that time, 2-3 years ago. There was Putin, let's make Mother Russia great again, Xi Jinping. China will stand up and will not be humiliated and we will flex our muscle. There was Erdogan from Turkey. The Ottoman Empire was a tragedy when the Turks had the caliphate and we were humiliated and we're flexing our muscle again. There was a man with a bad haircut saying, let's make America great again. And it suddenly hit me. You would never hear a German chancellor say, let's make Germany great again. They know whose voice they were hearing. They know where hypernationalism leads. Hypernationalism is a response to the fragmentation of community, to the anxiety, to the fear. But it leads to war. That's where it leads. Patriotism is a love of place without wanting to impose that on anyone else, saying this lifestyle has to be for you. Well, in pulling this together, the contest around justice goes to the question, how do we live together in a world? With climate change, we can see how advanced the Swedes are in their measures in dealing with it, because they have a sense of the whole, that egalitarian whole. We can see how backward Trump and many with that liberal notion is, that America first, always, so we're out of the Paris Accord. Whether it's climate change, whether it's in Australia, Indigenous rights, you know, We took John Locke's ideas, even though we were settled after him. John Locke said, when a human tills the ground and through their labour adds value to waste land, it becomes their property. That's what Locke said. Using those sort of ideas, we said, well, Indigenous aren't tilling. They don't add value to the land. We squatters, we settlers do. Therefore, it was never theirs. We had other arguments like those Indigenous are sort of a species of a wild beast. They're not really one blood with us. They're not really human. How do we come together and live together? I want to finish with this story because it's the hopeful story told in my book, Hope. One of my friends, first time in Africa, is out on a dusty road, 2 hours out from an African capital. Thick forest on either side. A massive tree has fallen across the road. And there's no way with a thick bush for the lorry that he's in to keep going. Sitting atop the tree is one lone African with a tomahawk, futilely chipping away at this massive tree. Another lorry comes the other way. Everyone jumps off. They say, let's try chains. They back up. They get out the chains. The tree's so massive they can't get chains around it. They say, what are we going to do? They realise the only strategy is literally their strength. So all of them, both lorries, put their shoulder to this massive tree. On three, they heave. It's such a dead weight, it barely shudders. It's hopeless. My friend Dave, who experienced this, said he'd never been to Africa before. He thought he was out in the back of nowhere. But suddenly people are appearing out of the bush. You don't know who they are. You don't know where they've come from. And they're enlisted. And on three, they heave. With the extra Africans who've come, it sort of shudders, but it's not moving. It's hopeless. They say one last time, it's two bone-jarring hours to go back the way we came. Let's not give up one last time. Dave said, my friend, he put his shoulder to this massive tree this third time. A frail, elderly African man had just come out of the bush. Dave remembers him because this African snuggled in with his shoulder next to Dave. Dave remembers him because he looked at him and thought, fat lot of good you're going to do. Frail and elderly. This African man started to sing. It was an African song, and the Africans clearly were waiting for a point, a crescendo. And as he sang a song, it hit that point, and they all heaved. This massive tree moved maybe a quarter of a centimetre. They took a breather. They put their shoulders again. The African man started to sing. Dave said, I was ready this time. It hit that note, they heaved. It moved a quarter of a centimetre. Dave said, we sang and heaved 70, 80 times until we'd moved that trunk just enough for the lorry to be able to squeeze through and go on. Dave said, you know, the mission never changed. It was to move that tree. The strategy never changed. It couldn't be tomahawk. It couldn't be chains. It could only be human effort. So what changed? What changed was a frail African man song that reached into our hearts and found something that didn't seem to be there before. A song that got us into alignment and released something. In thinking about how we can live together, that song has to be, we're all frail humans trying to get by. We all need community. But we need beyond community to see that the common challenges of climate change and displaced people and compassion has to be the alignment we get into to deal with our problems. Let us, as you've begun with a song, listen for the refrain of that song. Thank you.
Can you believe Tim Costello is in the Bega Valley to share his wisdom with us? Thank you. Tim, you speak to a room of teachers, nurses, small business owners, high school students, grave diggers, shy counsellors. Your words today inspire their work in our community. Thank you so much. We have time for one quick question of Tim. Genevieve Jacobs is on the floor with our roving microphone.
Are you willing to comment on Witness K?
Witness K, yeah, I find this simply appalling. I am shocked about my country. So we spy on East Timor. We have a foreign minister who, Alexander Downer, who when he leaves politics goes and works for Woodside, the very company that stood to benefit from the spying and trying to get the boundaries dealt in a different way. We then charge Witness K and Bernard Collery, is that how I say his name, the lawyer, when democracy, the oxygen is actually knowing what our politicians do and holding them accountable. And they've done, in my view, wrong spying on East Timor. And when the wrong has the light shone on it, the people who've actually been the truth tellers for the oxygen of democracy are charged. I find this just utterly, utterly appalling. So whenever I get a chance, I speak up for both of them.
Ladies and gentlemen, please thank Tim Costello.